This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Picture an Olympic-sized swimming pool filled with oil. Now drain one of those pools every 15 seconds, and that's the world's current oil consumption. One of the key issues President Bush focused on this week in his State of the Union address was energy. The speech called for a 22% increase in clean energy research at the Department of Energy. Research into solar and wind power, ways to produce ethanol, nuclear power, and cleaner coal. Critics point out that the speech came about a month after the release of the budget, which cut spending for the National Renewable Energy Laboratory by $28 million. 30 to 40 of the lab's employees will be laid off. So is the White House really serious about increasing research dollars, or is it just rhetoric? Some people and businesses are not waiting for the government to act. Some are taking the initiative. This hour, we'll talk about energy independence. Is it attainable? What are some of the alternatives to oil? Can energy policy be complete without thinking about greenhouse gas emissions? The president didn't talk about that this week. Or about energy conservation. Perhaps conservation could buy us many more years of energy-free or a reduction in oil consumption. We'll also talk to the folks at Whole Foods. You know, that's the store that announced that it will be buying electricity from wind power sources. Will others follow? What do you think? If you'd like to talk oil alternatives, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. As always, you're welcome to surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com. Let me introduce my guests. Peter Toutakian is the chief energy economist and director of the ARC Financial Corporation. That's ARC Financial Corporation. He's also author of the book, 1,000 Barrels a Second, The Coming Oil Breakpoint, and the Challenges Facing an Energy-Dependent World. That's published this year by McGraw-Hill. He's based in Calgary, British Columbia, but he joins us from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Jerome Ringo is the president of the Apollo Alliance. That's a group pushing for freedom from foreign oil while creating jobs. He joins us by phone. Welcome.
Thank you.
We didn't hear Jerome, we didn't hear that much about creating jobs when the president was talking about alternative energy. You would think he might use that as a prop or as a reason to go to these alternative technologies.
Unfortunately, there was a lot we did not hear. Fortunately, and I applaud the president, that was one thing we did hear, was an admission of America's addiction to foreign oil. I think that it's the beginning of an opportunity for America to get into a 12-step program for recovery from this addiction. That first step was accomplished for us, thank you, Mr. President, by admitting we have a problem. The second step must be for him to abandon that modest proposal to reduce our dependency on foreign oil that he presented in his address. I believe beyond that, the president must also consider the rest of the 10 steps, which Apollo Alliance outlines in its 10-point plan for America's energy independence by 2015.
All right, we'll get into some of those. I want to talk to Peter, and in your book, I mentioned at the beginning about this Olympic-sized swimming pool, which is being drained every 15 seconds.
Right.
You say that we're going to be reaching a point this year where we'll be using 1,000, barrels per second of oil?
1,000 barrels per second. Yeah, that's correct.
Wow.
It's, we get desensitized often by talking in the industry about millions of barrels per day and so on. So when I ran the numbers and you convert it to barrels per second, it's 1,000 barrels per second, which in itself is just a number, but hopefully, when you put it in the perspective of a milestone like 1,000 barrels per second, it becomes more real.
What did you think of the president's attack on energy this week?
Well, like Jerome, I thought it was very pivotal that he made an admission to the problem. That is absolutely key. In my book, I call that the rallying cry, and rallying cries have been used historically in other nations, particularly during times of crisis, to try and alter the course of energy consumption, the way we live, the way we consume energy. So it's that was pivotal.
Mm-hmm. My apologies, Jerome, for putting you in British Columbia. Peter, it's...
Oh, yes, it's in Alberta.
It's Alberta, I know, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
let me ask you, Jerome, where do you think... You gave us step number one. You said you had laid out all 12 steps. What would be steps 2, 3, and 4 on your list of addiction?
Step two, of course, is for the president to abandon that modest proposal that he presented to the American people. The other 10 steps, as I said, is Apollo Alliance initiative to for energy independence by 2015, which includes promoting advanced technology and hybrid cars. We need to invest in more efficient factories. We need to encourage high-performance buildings. We need to increase use of energy-efficient appliances and modernize electrical infrastructures. We must expand renewable energy development. We must improve transportation options. We must reinvest in smart urban growth and plan for a hydrogen future and preserve regulatory protections. Mm-hmm. These things are a must.
Is it possible to do this without hurting the economy? Because every time we hear the president talking about global warming or something involved with energy, he always makes sure that he says we can't do this, you know, rush into this because it might hurt the economy.
A bold initiative for energy independence will create 3 million jobs. We're going to create jobs in manufacturing and farms and in construction. The people that have signed up and the organizations that have signed up to support the Apollo initiative, such as labor, we have 23 national and international labor unions that promote and support jobs and believe that these steps taken by Apollo and the initiatives that we put forth will create jobs in the areas of research and development, in the areas of greening our buildings and our cities, in areas of rebuilding, re-energizing, educating. Is going to be a tremendous opportunity for America as we consider alternative energy and at the same time reducing our dependency on foreign oils.
Mm-hmm. Peter, the president went through step one, as Jerome has been telling us. What do you think is the biggest problem in our addiction, and how do we get away from that?
Well, the biggest problem...
I want to ask Peter that question.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah, the biggest problem is there's tremendous inefficiencies. But let me characterize it a different way. The big part of the issue here is that there's a lot of emphasis being placed on technology. And while I don't debate that technology in the long term will win the day, I think the issues are much more near term than that. And, you know, the president's speech also said the best way to break the addiction is through technology. Well, what does that tell the people? That tells the people that the onus is now on the scientists and that, people, you don't have to worry because we're going to find another magic bullet to save the day here. And I think that sends somewhat of a wrong message, because the rally cry, while it was good, I think the rally cry has to now reach the individual person rather than putting it on the shoulders of the scientists. Because at the end of the day, technological change and technological adoption in the energy business is not like the same as it is in consumer electronics or other high-tech industries. Change takes a long time, and the issues are over the course of the next 5-10 years, and a lot of these high-tech things that are being proposed are beyond that horizon in terms of making a meaningful dent in the problem.
So are you talking about conservation, things that individuals can do themselves, things like that?
Yes, I mean, in part, that's part of it's one dimension of many that needs to be considered when enacting policy decisions. Conservation is the lowest hanging fruit. I mean, you know, we don't need high tech solutions. We don't need necessarily the engineering marvel of hybrids. Although I'm not knocking it at all. I mean, it's wonderful. But all you have to do is buy a smaller car. I mean, the fuel economy gains in buying a smaller vehicle are almost the same as buying a hybrid. So. There's lifestyle and the way we live type of issues that have to be addressed. And I think Jerome pointed that out. I think he said it was step four or step five, the way that we live and the migration of the communities.
Why do you think, and I'll ask both of you, why do you think it was so politically troubling and it continues to be politically troubling for the president to talk about, for example, energy efficiency, raising the miles per gallon, the CAFE standards for cars? Is it the voters in the car-making states? People can't have their SUVs? Or what do you think it is?
Well, it's just politically unpalatable in a nation that prides itself on free market economics to meddle in free market economics by imposing standards on either, you know, one specific industry such as the auto industry. I think that comes to the heart of the issue.
But you could do it on all industries, refrigeration, auto, you know, building materials. Peter, what do you, Jerome, what do you think?
Well, I believe, you know, there are many steps that we can take across the board. Collectively, it's going to take the efforts of people changing their lifestyles as well as innovative new technologies to get the job done, to bring us to that energy independence. I think there are many considerations and options and ideas that can be explored, but I think collectively we get the job done. Surely Americans can change their lifestyles and drive smaller cars at the same time. We have to strive for more energy-efficient cars and come up with standards that will not negatively impact the American economy and take jobs away, but bring new jobs to us.
Well, the cars don't have to be smaller, you know, to be more energy efficient. You can put more energy efficient engines in a bigger car, which the Toyota is doing, for example.
Absolutely.
Well, you can, but, you know, I'd like to point out that the internal combustion engine has evolved over the last 100, 150 years. And in terms of the efficiency of the engine, we've pretty much maxed out and approaching the limits of physics here. The real problem is the stop-and-go congestion in the traffic and the fact that the American public over the course of the last 15 to 20 years has migrated out to the suburbs and are driving 20% more compared to what they were driving 15 years ago. And we continue to migrate out to the suburbs.
But we have hybrids that are made just for that kind of city driving.
Well, they are, and they're great. I'm not knocking it. But I think you have, you have to put it in perspective. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying they are. You know, Toyota announced this week they're going to build a Camry hybrid. I mean, the most popular car in America.
Sure. And I think hybrids are great again. But again, now we've come to the heart of another problem, which is understanding the time horizon with which change takes place. Introducing hybrids are great. I think in 2005, there were some 200,000 sold in the United States. It's a great start. But bear in mind that there's 230 million registered vehicles that have to be churned through and made more efficient. So great start. But you can imagine how long it's going to take to churn through the inefficiencies of the entire American fleet of vehicles before meaningful change is made to the vehicle fuel economy of the fleet.
All right, we have to take a short break. We'll come back and talk lots more about energy efficiency, about the president's speech. We'll talk about ethanol. We'll get into that. I know you all want to talk about that, too. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about energy and the reaction to President Bush's State of the Union address this week about it with my guests, Peter Terzakian, the chief energy economist at ARC Financial Corporation, author of the book 1,000 Barrels a Second, Jerome Ringo, president of the Apollo Alliance. I want to switch gears a little bit because the president mentioned quite specifically about ethanol. And a gentleman, he said, you know, that we might want to switch toward an ethanol or adding more ethanol into a mix of with our gasoline. Peter, what do you think about that?
Well,
Is that going to work?
It will work in complementing gasoline over the course of the next couple of decades. Is it going to make a difference in the time horizon that I think is most immediate, which is the next 5 to 10 years? I would say it's probably unlikely.
What do you think, Jerome?
Well, you know, President Bush proposed more research on a range of clean energy technologies, of course, ethanol from corn and switchgrass and better car batteries, and that paves the way for plug-in hybrids and wind and solar power. All these technologies can contribute to energy independence over time, and ethanol is homegrown, and it can be made from a variety of crops. If we improve batteries, we can move toward flex-fuel gas ethanol cars, and it can also plug into ordinary electrical outlets. You know, these cars are solutions if we can make these electricity from the wind and the sun. But to get there, I believe that the president should provide some incentives, federal loan guarantees that are sort of enable Detroit to retool and manufacture those flex fuel cars.
The president, the budget that came out just this week, earmarks a lot of money for individual projects in energy to a lot of different companies. Isn't that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Yeah, and I think that's true, but it goes beyond that. I just think that when you consider some of the record profits by oil companies, this is money. Some of that money could surely be reintroduce back into the market to promote alternative energy let's create some incentive to invest back into these technologies. So I think that the president presented some things that were good. Unfortunately, he didn't present enough of it, or enough of it that would really make a difference.
I want to bring on another guest, Dan Kamen, who's director of the Renewable and Appropriate Energy Laboratory and co-director of the Berkeley Institute of the Environment at UC Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
How you doing, Ira?
Hi. There has been a lot of debate about ethanol. There are some people have been saying, you know, this is a miracle, so to speak, product to add to a gasoline. Others have been saying, you know, when you make ethanol, it takes more energy than you get out of ethanol. You have to use oil to grow the crops. You have to use oil energy to make the fertilizer. When you put all that together, when you grow the crops or you use it from the waste left over from corn, let's say, or from the corn itself, you're left with ethanol, but you've put in more energy than you've gotten out of it. You published a paper in Science that says that's not true.
Well, that's right. In fact, it's that debate that's been raging for 20 years that really got us interested in the issue. There have been a number of studies that came out on both sides. Some people saying, as you said, it's a miracle crop. Some others said it's an energy wasteland. And so we really wanted to not only do our own analysis, but also try to clarify the debate. So what we did was we built a model where we took the six most sort of prominent models available today from nonprofit groups, universities, Department of Agriculture. We built them all side by side, and we built our own scenarios based on what we thought was the best available data. And we concluded, just what you said, that in terms of displacing gasoline, so sort of an energy security argument, ethanol from corn is a significant winner. In fact, it can displace about 95% of the gasoline, meaning you need that 5% left to make the, to run the tractors, to make the fertilizer, et cetera. So we conclude that it's, in fact, a clear winner on the displacing fossil fuel side, and that's what most of the studies in the literature say. But what we did find, though, was that ethanol is a very mild winner, if it's grown from corn, in terms of greenhouse gases. We find that maybe you get a 10 or 15% reduction in greenhouse gases by going to ethanol versus gasoline, but that if you get your ethanol from cellulose, it's just a really exciting big winner on both sides. And the president mentioned cellulose by name in this State of the Union address, and we do need to do some research on it, but it really does look like the future of where ethanol may come from in this country.
Well, walk us through where you would get the cellulose from. He mentioned these grasses that grow wild on the prairies.
That's right, and I even heard that there was a speech that his Crawford Ranch, he was going to start growing switchgrass, which I'm sure really thrilled the switchgrass lobby. Before you even get to, are we going to grow new bioenergy crops, like growing switchgrass or fast-growing?
Well, what is switchgrass? For those of us who are not switchgrass farmers, what is a switchgrass?
So switchgrass is basically...
We don't see much of that in New York here, so we're trying to...
not growing on Fifth Avenue, that's for sure. Basically, these are woodier, more fibrous crops, and so any time you mush up corn, you get kind of a mush, a corn mush. But when you do up the cellulosic crops, you see those little kind of soft splinters in there. That's a sign of the lignin. That's the tougher material that you can break down into ethanol. And so basically you're talking about denser, more fibrous material to get your ethanol from. And that kind of opens the door to a whole range of sorts of crops that we could begin to grow. But before we get there, we have a huge amount of bio waste in this country. Sawmills typically waste, not they don't intentionally, but about a third of the material from a tree doesn't go into sawn wood. All that stuff is potential crop matter. Lots of the residues from different farm products are also our potential products. And so we've got already in this country a very large resource of unused cellulose that we could make into ethanol without even converting one more acre of land into a bioenergy crop.
Now, Brazil is the world leader in ethanol. The U.S. has put a tax on buying ethanol from Brazil, 50 cents a gallon or something like that?
That's right.
And we could buy a lot of ethanol from Brazil, but there's a strong lobby against it.
Well, there is. I don't disagree with that to start off with. I mean, right now, because we do have so much biomass we're not using, I think it makes sense to support American industry, American farmers, not protectionism, but let's build up our industry. I mean, Brazil has a 25-year head start because they got going on this when everyone basically laughed at them. And now Brazil meets half of its gasoline equivalent for passenger vehicles with ethanol. Ethanol sells for about half of what gasoline does at the pump there, and it's a raging success. In fact, Japan has a very large contract with Brazil to export about $1.4 billion worth of ethanol to Brazil. So I would like to see us buy in that market, but I'd like to see us build up the domestic American industry first. Mm.
Well, they make ethanol from sugarcane, right?
Mm-hmm.
And is that a different kind of ethanol that would come out of sugarcane versus what we would be making?
It is. We're not likely to go sugarcane here because it's the climate in Brazil is suited for it. It's not here. It's quite water intensive. I see these other crops, like switchgrass, which can grow in prairies and areas, sugar beets, a whole range of things, as well as, again, some of the fast-growing trees that are more likely to be our crop. And I did just hear that at least one auto manufacturer is going to use the Super Bowl as a chance to unleash a new campaign called Live Green, Go Yellow, which is clearly a corn-based ethanol program. And we haven't even started to think about what are the ways that we might optimize corn to make it a better source of the ethanol, given that we're certainly going to use corn-based ethanol in the short term as this cellulosic industry takes off.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's go to Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey.
Hi there. Yes, I'd like to talk about the new Million Solar Roofs initiative here in California. Mm-hmm. They just passed it with a whole new rebate program. Plus, we'll be able to sell our generated power back to the utility for credits and I believe, cash. And I think the route to the future is that we plug in our electric cars, at least here in California, into our solar electric rooftops, because with the coming of the new plug-in hybrid, it makes sense because it goes 60 miles before gasoline engine kicks in, so you can go to work and come back. The average commute is 60 miles, so you just plug it into your solar rooftop, and I think that is the way of the future, especially to cut the carbon in the air. And about the war on oil here in Iraq, they're allocating another $70 billion for it, and that's, I hate to say that, but the people of America are financing the war for the war on oil, and then they don't even get the booty. The oil companies get the booty, and they're getting untold profits, Exxon and Chevron. They're selling the booty back to America at unbelievably high prices. So I think America is getting totally ripped off by this, and it's time to go solar.
Can we get Peter to jacking? Any reaction?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, the big issue here is I think the big issue here in broad terms is understanding the scale of the issue. Okay, the scale of the issue, both from an oil perspective and from an electricity perspective, from a number of vehicles perspective. You really need to understand there's 230 million vehicles. If all of those started to plug into the electricity grid, you've got a big problem. The electrical grid is already stressed. Solar panels, wind turbines, these are all great. Unfortunately, they're not easily scalable. Again, I'm not trying to go down on these things. I think they're wonderful technologies. Mm-hmm. They have their place. But people need to come to grips with the scale of the problem that we're dealing with. I like to say that a lot of these things are just a drip in the barrel when it comes to solving the problems. And the time horizons for substitution of these new technologies is not measured in months or even years. It's often measured in decades. Brazil is a great example. I mean, it was mentioned. They've started in 1975. It's 30 years they've been doing this. We're at ground zero here.
Yeah,
we had that opportunity with President Carter, and when he
declared.
Although there is a difference. I mean, Carter had the right intention, but many of these technologies just weren't ready for prime time. Technically and definitely financially, then energy efficiency was and has been. But I'd like to comment on both that last statement and also the caller before. It is true that these things take a while to change, but we have seen Germany, which does not have a particularly great wind resource, go from a relatively small player to the world's dominant installer of wind power in under a decade. Northern Germany today gets 25% of its electricity from wind on the average month, and it peaks at 50. So while Peter's right that these changes can take a long time and take some real leadership, we also have examples like Brazil offsetting half their gasoline, like Germany doing this, like Denmark being a great exporter of windmills, and California with this new plan to basically extend the current existing rebate for solar. I'd contend that we haven't even tried to explore the upside very much yet, and we may discover that the Germany examples are actually more common than we think, when you start putting solar on everyone's rooftop, who knows how the grid and utilities may respond to take advantage of that?
Did Germany have to redo its grid? Because one of the things we've talked about this for years on this program, and we keep hearing, you know, wind is a great idea, except how do you get the energy to the grid?
Right.
I mean, because you're going to be in isolated areas where the wind is blowing. Did Germany have to redesign its grid? And in this country, we know how creaky the grid is.
Right.
It would be a great opportunity to redesign the grid.
Well, it would.
If you go to a giant scale project, you know, an Apollo moon project sort of idea about energy.
That's right. Well, Germany, in fact, did not have to redo the grid in any way that wasn't planned. They were already rebuilding, largely because after their reunification with East Germany, they were investing in the grid anyway. And you don't need to put billions into it to put wind on. What you need to do is to make sure that you have lines going out to where the wind farms are going to be. And so they did some advanced planning. But it also turns out, and this and Britain's doing the same thing, there are many old, as you call them, creaky power lines, where actually what you need to stabilize it is some power not at the central station but out at the end of the line. And so what England is doing right now is they're installing relatively small wind farms, 1, 2, 3 turbines, at the end to help stabilize it. And so you do need to do some planning, which is, of course, not the U.S.'s strong suit in this regard. But we're already on a program right now to invest something like $100 billion in the grid just to bring it back up to code. So this is the right time to do the things we need to do to make the grid so-called smart. Mm-hmm. So that it can take the wind power from one person's roof and the solar off of my roof and the power that a building that decides to go green and generate more than it needs can feed that power back in, just like the last caller mentioned. Mm-hmm.
Talking about energy this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I would think, Jerome Ringo, that considering all the construction and building and whatever that would be needed to convert to alternative energies like wind and other things and helping the grid, that businesses would jump on this idea, would love to.
And businesses are jumping on the idea. The Apollo Alliance has part of its alliance, a business element that is growing daily. Businesses and large companies, as well as small businesses, are becoming very interested in how they can get involved in the whole oil independence idea, energy independence idea, and how they can become more involved in the alternative energy debate. And as well, there is legislation that's already being presented and have been presented, concepts like that of Senator Maria Cantwell from Washington. She has proposals on the table that would reduce imports of foreign oil. She has proposals on the table that would cut by 40% oil imports by 2025. I believe that these initiatives that are on the table should be considered by the White House to beef up the inadequate plan that the president presented to us just several nights ago. So there are opportunities here. Businesses are getting on board. We have a broad constituency of individuals and organizations getting on board because this is good for America and good for the economy of America.
Dan, before I let you go, I want to ask you, is there enough land out there to grow the kinds of grasses and things and corn that we would need to make all the ethanol?
Right. Well, so
and would we be taking food out of people's mouths rather than?
It's a good question. The current analysis, and I'm going to refer to work done by the Natural Resources Defense Council, indicates that there is plenty of land, and not even needing to go to much new acreage. And land that we're paying farmers not to grow on is a wonderful resource. But also the resource I mentioned in the beginning, that we haven't even begun to explore how much of our current waste stream we could put into this. And so in California's Central Valley, where there's real air pollution problems from burning rice shells and the shells from walnuts and offtake from the farms, all that is a resource. And so we may discover that at the point that ethanol, ideally cellulosic, becomes 30% of our total transportation fuels, that would be a nice point to get to, that we need to make some trade-offs. But we're so far from that now, and we have such a large resource that is being wasted or actually has negative costs because we burn it to get rid of it, that we've got a huge upside. In California, there is an initiative that's coming down the pipe that will ask over 10 years for the state to reduce its gasoline use by fully a quarter. And that will actually be funded on what I believe it was Jerome mentioned before, that was a tax on the on the very high profits in the oil industry right now. And so I certainly see those as options that all work together to do what you're describing.
All right, stay with us. We'll be right back. We're going to take a short break and switch and bring on the Whole Foods people who are talking about wind energy. So we'll be right back. Stay with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about energy, alternative energies, getting off that oil addiction. Sounds like deja vu all over again. I know, we've been talking about it for 35 years. My guests are Jerome Ringo, president of the Apollo Alliance, Peter Tsourtakian, the chief energy economist at ARC Financial Corporation, author of the book, 1,000 Barrels a Second. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to the phone call for a quick call. George in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, George.
Hi, guys.
Hi there.
Hello.
Ira and gentlemen, I would like to ask, it seems that hydrogen fuel cells have just been completely missing from all this. I wanted to know what happened to all that. That seemed very promising.
But the president did mention, I think, fuel cells, did he not, in his State of the Union? But he didn't talk about hydrogen in general. You're right. Peter, what do you think?
Well, I think they're very far out. I mean, you know, we've got to talk about this stuff not from the perspective of new technology, but from the perspective of these things being products. And the adoption of products is dependent upon them being compellingly better and cheaper. For example, DVDs over VCRs. Compelling product, now cheaper, sales take off. I mean, I think this is the issue with not only hydrogen vehicles, but even that of, say, ethanol vehicles, is have to really demonstrate that these things are compellingly better and cheaper and offer the same sort of utility that we're accustomed to. In other words, range and easeability, easy to fill up and so on. And so the prospects for hydrogen being compellingly better and cheaper over the course of the near term is very, very unlikely. Probably toward the end of the next decade, I think we may start to see something, but not in the near term.
Well, if you don't prepare in the future for it, how do you ever get to the next decade?
No, absolutely right. I mean, my argument in all of this is that we don't want to condition the people to thinking that there's overnight solutions here, which is, I think, what is being done in some of these public policy speeches where, you know, don't worry, the scientists will take care of it. Will be independent in 6 or 10 years. I mean, this is the type of thing we have to get away from. We need to have an admission of the real scale of the problem and the fact that it's not going to be solved overnight. And the rally cry, I think, as even Jerome mentioned, needs to be strengthened.
Jerome, the rally cry, might it show some leadership?
And I agree that the changes are going to be more evolutionary than revolutionary. But there's got to be a catalyst to get the changes started. The president fell short of that opportunity, and the Apollo plan, which includes plans for a hydrogen future to invest in long-term research and development for hydrogen fuel cells technology, the president missed that as an opportunity to actually get this moving forward. I think it is a process that will take some time, but eventually we will get there, and I think a great catalyst to get that moving is the 10-point plan for energy independence that Apollo Alliance is initiating.
On the other hand, he did bring it up for discussion, and you know, we're talking about it today. A lot of people have been talking about it this week.
And, yes, the president brought a number of things up for discussion. What my concern is that the president has in the past offered proposals, and then he's turned around and broken those promises. He's had a history of that. He brought proposals forward in the last State of the Union address. And just days after the address, the president's budget request cut funding for 7 renewable energy and energy efficient programs, including research for ethanol. So I'm not very optimistic with the promises of the president, with the hoopla and all that he is presenting. We'll just let his actions do the talking and see exactly how serious he is. And if he is, he will adopt programs and initiatives like that put forth by Senator Cantwell.
Mm-hmm. Well, instead of waiting for government action, some people are already acting on their own. The Whole Foods grocery, you may be familiar with them. It's a chain that announced that it would buy renewable energy credits for wind, sort of voucher saying that its energy was coming from a specific source, and in this case, wind power. And they announced not just a little bit of energy, enough wind power equal to the chain's entire electric consumption for the year. And while it's not putting the windmills on the roofs of every store, the deal makes the company the largest buyer of wind energy credits in North America. Joining me now is Michael Besonson. He's the Southern Pacific Regional President for Whole Foods Market, which is based in Austin, Texas. He joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Pleased to be here.
Yeah, how much energy are we talking about in megawatts?
We're looking at 458,000 megawatt hours of renewable energy credits.
Wow. And why did you decide as a corporation to do this?
Well, one of the core values of Whole Foods Market from our very inception has been the community and environmental stewardship. And we've gotten to a size where we could actually make a difference and make a buy for renewable energy credits that meant something. And clearly it was significant based on the size. Actually, the largest user or buyer of renewable energy credits for wind is actually the U.S. Air Force.
Oh, well, so you're the commercial winner then.
We are the commercial winner. I think we're in pretty good technological company with the U.S. Air Force.
Yeah. And you know, and it's actually the Navy, I think, buys the most diesel fuel and is buying a biodiesel more than anybody else at this point.
I think you're correct.
Yeah. Now, this doesn't mean that your store or any of your stores individually actually get the wind power, right?
No. What happens is the wind generates electricity on wind farms across the country, Colorado, the Dakotas, California, Texas. And those electrons go into the grid. What we've done is we've bought the green attribute of the wind power to help sustain and build new wind farms, to continue to move us towards the energy independence that the president spoke about in his State of the Union address.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that you're based in Austin, Texas, because you may know that Texas has the second highest installed base of wind power.
Yep.
Next to California. And that happened under the governorship of President Bush.
Well, I couldn't speak to that. I don't know how that went down. I have my suspicions that it may not have been directly at his hand.
Right.
But certainly there's a lot of wind in Texas, and they've taken advantage of that.
Yeah, you know, they're a good model for the rest of the country. Texas has its own energy grid also, which makes it a little bit easier.
They've done a lot of good work down there. Also, yeah. Done a lot of work on biodiesel down there. So.
Have you heard from other large green conscious companies who say, you know, now that you've done this, maybe we should try it also?
We've heard rumblings.
Yeah.
I know that the people at Renewable Choice, who we bought our wind credits from, are hearing from folks. And I think that people will look at this and see that there really is something that can be done, that we can take steps as individual companies that can make a difference. And apparently we have to do that as companies to really move the country forward on renewable energy.
Mm-hmm. Michael Besonson, thank you for taking time to talk with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Ira.
He is the Southern Pacific Regional President for Whole Foods Market, and he's based in Austin, Texas. Our number, 1-800-985-8255, is our number. Also with us is Peter Tatakian, who is a Chief Energy Economist and Director of the RC Financial Corporation, author of 1,000 Barrels a Second, The Coming Oil Breakpoint and the Challenges Facing an Energy-Dependent World. Jerome Ringo, President of the Apollo Alliance. Jerome, what do you think of the Whole Foods Company's idea?
I don't have a lot of knowledge on their idea and really can't give you a lot of comment on it.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask Peter.
Well, I would say, you know, bravo. I mean, I think we need more of that type of corporate leadership and individual leadership. But I think it also brings about a really important point that needs to be addressed, and that is that whether it's wind, solar, nuclear, clean coal, all these things generate electricity. Okay? In the United States now, only 2%, 2 to 3% of the electricity generated comes from burning oil. That means that all these technologies are not substitutes for oil. And actually, I'd like to get back to Germany because
sure.
you point to that, and it's really important to know the distinction about that model and why it won't necessarily work over here. See, with reunification, East Germany was heavily dependent upon burning oil for generating electricity, and all these wind farms basically came in, which is great, and pushed oil burning out of the market. So indeed, Germany's oil consumption is going down. But here in the United States, that transition was made after the oil crises of the 1970s. Back then, 20% of the electricity generated came from oil. Jimmy Carter put in the Fuel Use Act, said you can't burn oil or natural gas, you have to go to coal and nuclear power. And those were the big-time substitutes that came in and pushed oil out of the U.S. electrical power market. So today, if you talk about windmills and solar panels and all the other electrical generating technologies, there is no more oil to push out of the U.S. power grid or nothing right. Substantial. The issue is in transportation.
Cars, buses, trucks, things like that.
Cars, SUVs, trucks. That is where the issue is. And, you know, when we talk about this addiction that President Bush talks about, I mean, it's actually in my book. I talk about the addiction. The issue is, like, what are we trying to do here? We're telling somebody, say, for example, who is an alcoholic and he's addicted to vodka. And metaphorically, when you talk about ethanol, we're saying, okay, let's switch this guy over to vodka or to bourbon, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the issue is that you're addicted. Maybe you ought to try to think about easing off the bottle rather than just switching the fuels around.
Mm-hmm. But is that going to come from the top down or from the grassroots
well,
up?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, it's a holistic thing. I mean, the policy initiatives that are required that follow the rally cry have to be multi-pronged. You can, as I said from the beginning, you cannot rely exclusively just on technology. There has to be more to it than that. There has to be wholesale change of attitude in terms of what the people drive, how they live, and things like that. I mean, it's there are no easy solutions, and that's really what the book is about. Is that, you know, we really have to think that there are no longer any easy solutions.
Yet the president never asks us to sacrifice. Presidents have.
Absolutely, and you know my contention is that will have to come, and that is when you know that the real rally cry is here. The rally cry with the teeth that says, "Okay, now you have to think about lifestyle."
Mm-hmm. Talking with Peter Tutsakian, an author of 1,000 Barrels a Second, The Coming Oil Breakpoint, and the Challenges Facing an Energy-Dependent World. Jerome Ringo, president of the Apollo Alliance, on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two. We have to go. Bonnie in Sheldon, New York. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I belong to a small group of people in Sheldon, New York, who are fighting against the larger wind turbine companies who are funded by private people. We're trying to get our own wind turbines up and running so that we want to propose our own energy and get the benefits from it for our own town. They want to propose many turbines in our town. And quite frankly, it's upstate New York. They'll ruin the beautiful, pristine countryside that's here. And we don't agree with it, but it's being pushed and forced upon us. And so we're looking now towards putting up maybe, you know, 40 wind turbines as the proposed 86 turbines. And our farmers who want them on their land, who will benefit from the money, and our town that will benefit from the money, we'll get lots more money.
So you're saying you're not opposed to the turbines, you just want fewer of them and spaced out into other parts, so they're not all in your spot.
We want to have more of a say as to where they go and how many of them get put up.
And where do you think this is going to, do you think you have a chance of
well,
being successful?
Well, a town near us called Perry is in fact working with a congressman to get some funding for their own turbine company. Mm-hmm.
Well, good luck to you, Bonnie.
Yes.
Thanks for calling. We're running out of time. You're welcome. What do you think of that, Peter? Now we're starting to see some
right.
of the turf battle.
Well, this highlights another problem. There are four dimensions to energy in general that we need to consider. People over the course of the last decade several decades have become accustomed to cheap, clean, secure, and what I call discrete energy. And the discrete means like not in my backyard. What I would argue to you is that it's not only oil, but it's all types of energies. Those four dimensions, cheap, clean, secure, and discrete, do not go together anymore. You can't have it all. People have to start making choices. So if you want your energy to be cheap, you know, I'm sorry, you're going to have to put up with some pipelines or some wind turbines or whatever. The only thing that could mitigate that, as I said, is changing lifestyle, conservation, and so on. So, I mean, we are in a period where people are going to have to start thinking about making lifestyle choices. And if you want it cheap, you're going to have to sacrifice something.
And we're not expecting the price of oil to come down a whole lot anymore. It's a new ball game now, is what you're saying.
It is. We're in a period of transition. It's one of those rare transitions in the history of energy, which is really what the book talks about, where things are going to have to get shaken up. And I guess really what I'm arguing is you can expect the price of oil to spike up a lot higher, and I'm not alone in saying that. And I think that will ultimately catalyze the rally cry.
And make alternative energy options seem more viable because
Sure, sure. But even more important than that, the rally cry will have to address the issue of, you know, how do we balance these four dimensions that I talked about? If you want it cheap, you're going to have to sacrifice something.
What would you say the rally cry is?
Well, the rally cry is very similar to something like the rally cry after September 11th, the war on terror. I mean, that is the strength of this nation, is the people to rally around the flag, around a cause. And just imagine if that type of rally cry were applied to this energy situation, what you could do.
Yeah. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us. Peter Chatakian is the Chief Energy Economist and Director of the ERC Financial Corporation, also author of the book, 1,000 Barrels a Second, The Coming Oil Breakpoint and the Challenges Facing an Energy-Dependent World. Also, thank you, Jerome Ringel, President of the Apollo Alliance, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Our program is produced by Annette Heiss, Senior Producer Karen Vergoth. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington, Charles Berquist in New York. Our interns are Flora Lichtman and Andrea Thompson. Megan Moline and Susan Lund worked the phones for us today. If you'd like to write us, send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. Surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, and you can podcast us if you missed back editions or you'd like to hear this one again. You can download a podcast from there. Also, Science Friday's Kids Connection. Free teaching material that we make for teachers having trouble teaching science. We'll help you out how to teach it in your classrooms. We make the free teaching material based on Science Friday. Just click on the For Teachers button right there on the left side of the page at sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.